Älskar du den här podden? Stötta den genom IKAs nya supporterfunktion. Det är helt upp till dig hur mycket du vill bidra med och det finns ingen bindningstid. Klicka på länken i poddbeskrivningen för att visa din uppskattning och stötta podden.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Andy Schell and his Swedish wife Mia own a sailboat, the Isbjörn. Around that boat, they have built a fantastic business. And just like me, Andy runs a podcast. With very few exceptions, Andy interviews people who, just like himself, are fully dedicated to sailing. So if you are dreaming about an exciting life at sea, you should definitely check out and subscribe to the podcast On the Wind. My name is Magnus Ormestad and this is the Swedish outdoor podcast Husky. This episode is a bit different than the usual ones. We released the exact same episode in both Husky and On the Wind, and it is perhaps a bit more of a discussion than a regular interview. We share our thoughts about our different projects, about daring to follow our dreams, and about life in the mountains and at sea. Find out more about this episode and of previous episodes at huskypodcast.com, where you also will find links to Andy and Mia's business. Follow them on Instagram at the handle 59 North Sailing, and on Facebook you can look them up at 59 North. Husky is made with support from Naturkompaniet and the new holiday club in Åre.
Why did you change the name from 59 to On the Wind?
Well, 59 North was always just a default name because I couldn't think of anything better. And talking of branding, it was like I wanted to. Well, my brand is 59 North, so I might as well have something that stays in that line, but mainly it was because I couldn't think of anything better. And then, have you seen my TV show? I actually have
no.
One episode published, one more about to be published. I'll show it to you afterwards.
Really?
But we had a brainstorm about what to call the TV show, which is essentially a TV version of this. And we came up with On the Wind. So then I just branded the podcast the same thing because I liked the name.
But wasn't it did you to kind of rebrand the entire back catalog or something?
I didn't rebrand it. I just kept it as the evolution. I called it On the Wind is the evolution of 59 North. Mm-hmm. Took it from there. So it's the same podcast feed, and you go through like the archive, and there's different artwork depending on what stage of the progression it's been in. But now it's set. So I've started recording, by the way. So.
Yeah. How did you end up on a sailboat the first time?
I've told this. I'm going to give you the short version because I've told this story a lot on my podcast.
Okay.
My parents got me into it, and I didn't have a choice. When I was literally in diapers is when I first got on sailboats. And we're from the countryside in Pennsylvania, and it's like 2.5 hours to the Chesapeake Bay where my dad and mom always kept their boat. So it kind of was by default, and it was what we did in the summertime.
And we're talking ocean now.
Chesapeake Bay. Yeah.
Okay.
Basically the equivalent of sailing in the archipelago when it's a little bit more open water. Like where the boat was, it was a place called Rock Hall on the Chesapeake near Annapolis, Maryland, which is where sort of our U.S. base is now. The bay is about 4 miles wide there. So you can, you know, it's half hour sail across to the other side and back again. Pretty shallow water. And it's long. It's 130 miles long and not similar to the archipelago in that there's a lot of little creeks and stuff you can explore in the side. So that was my sort of childhood growing up on the boat in that setting. And I don't know what, at some point I wanted to go further. I didn't want to keep coming back to the same place we started from. And that was like a big thing. That was like, okay, I have to get this out of my system. And the long of the short of it, it's, I appreciate that sort of day sailing way more now than I did before, because now I know I've completed those goals along the way, and I can relax a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but that is in a way kind of your heritage. I mean, did your parents, did they sail as well growing up? It's like it runs back in the salt water runs in your family.
No, not really. My parents, the first time they got hooked was on their honeymoon. Actually, they were in their mid-20s, I think. And they chartered a boat out of Fort Lauderdale with a captain and a couple friends. And they went over to the Bahamas. And my mom always used to like to say that the instant the captain turned the engine off and they were moving just with the power of the wind, that's when she got hooked. And then they had dreams of going cruising, and they bought a 26-foot sailboat they kept on the bay for a while, learned the ropes, and then bought a 32-foot boat and took the winter off and went down to the Bahamas. This was in 1979, and they'd met a bunch of families on the way with young kids. This is before I was born. And they said, we have to do this again with our kids when we have kids. My mom always had a dream of raising us on the boat, moving, you know, selling everything, moving aboard and doing that. But my dad, it just didn't happen that way, because my dad had his own business and they were pretty content, had a close-knit, immediate family. And I wouldn't say it was like a regret. It was just that, okay, instead of doing that, we'll take a year off. So my fourth grade was spent living on the boat. Wow. I have a younger sister. We left Annapolis in October, cruised down the east coast of the U.S., hopped over to the Bahamas, which is only 60 miles from Florida, from Miami. Spent the winter cruising in the Bahamas, and then came back again in May, I think, of that year, 94 we came back, 93 we left, 94 we came back. And that was my fourth grade education, and that and
homeschooled.
Yeah, we were homeschooled on the boat. Yeah, I remember we had to read. One of the things was we each had to keep a journal, and I was 9 when we left, so my journal was more or less comprehensible because I was of the age where I could write. My sister's journal is hilarious to read now going back, because It's comprehensible, but it's not very well written. It's written like a 7-year-old or 6-year-old, whatever, however old she was. And it's just really, really funny. You know, for example, every night the routine was sort of, we had dinner, read a book, and went to bed. And it was like, that repeated itself. It was very truthful, as only a kid can write. It's like, wow, you guys sounded like you had an exciting time, had hot dogs for dinner, and went to bed. So it's fun to reflect on that. That was a big part of it. I remember doing a book report on Jurassic Park, the book, and I was like fourth grade, and I remember that's like the first adult book I read.
Well, Michael Crichton.
Exactly, yeah. But that trip is what I attribute the rest of my life to. Like, that's the first time I have real memories as a human. Because like I had a very stable childhood. My dad still lives in the house I grew up in. He built it the year I was born. So year to year, everything was more or less the same until then. That was like stood out in my mind as I really remember specific things from that year. And that really impacted me.
Like how everything smelled like and the feelings and touching everything. And
more the feeling, I guess, you know, the feeling of adventure and that sort of there is something else. Like you don't have to do what everybody else does. It sounds more, it probably wasn't like that when I was a kid. I think I just liked being out of school. But that's how I remember it. Yeah. And that's what's influenced me to follow the career I have since, I think.
But you never had kind of a like teenage, like that you wanted to rebel against all that and decide to be in like an accountant and I never want to sail again. And
I was the opposite of a rebellious teenager in every sense. I was a mama's boy, but I actually went to college for golf. I was going to be a golf professional.
But sailing saved you.
Sailing saved me. Yeah, I worked one summer at a country club, and I just couldn't. I still play golf for fun, but it wasn't. I'm not I'm physically not able to focus on something that I don't really care about. So whatever it is, if I care about it, I'll do it. If I don't care about it, I don't want to do it. And I'm just very lazy. So I'm, in one sense, the laziest, most productive person there is, because things I want to do, I'm great at. Things I don't have an interest in just doesn't
happen.
You
don't see the point in it.
No, I see the point. I just don't. Sometimes, like, I don't know, I'm generally a lazy person unless it's something I'm really passionate about. Then I go at it 150%. So I think that's what it was with golf. I just didn't care enough to put the time, because no matter what you end up doing, you have to put effort into it. And I can't do that unless I'm very selfish in that way, I guess, too. So,
but about education and so on, did you go to like university or something, or the equivalent?
No, I went to school, and I didn't go to, like, I didn't know I was gonna do a career. Doing a career in sailing never occurred to me until I graduated college. So in the U.S., basically everybody goes straight from high school to college, which is exactly what I did. I think I changed majors 6 times. At one point, my major was a double major in German and international business.
Well, still speaking in German?
No. The Swedish has buried the German deep down in there somewhere.
Yeah, that's got to have been, wasn't that a bit helpful, like learning Swedish?
Helpful with German?
Yeah, a bit. No.
I mean, maybe. If I went to Germany, I think it would come back. But like, I just, the Swedish, like I said, is on top, and the German's buried in there somewhere. But I don't, I mean, it's one of those things, you use it or lose it, and it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, I studied Chinese for 2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Chinese and political science, international relations. So it's also very out there, sort of. But I haven't, you know, haven't been back to that.
Yeah, yeah. I've only been to Germany even once, and I ordered a beer in German. I can still do that. Oh. But no, the sailing thing didn't occur to me until I ended up majoring in tourism management, and that required a 12-credit internship, so one full semester had to be an internship to graduate. And I had 2 opportunities. I could either go, and at that point I knew I wanted to do, I didn't know I wanted to do something in sailing, but that was an interest, and I was like, I'm going to try and go somewhere on an internship where I can sail. That sounds cool. So the Navy has a program called Morale, Welfare, and Recreation. Morale, Welfare, and Recreation.
Okay.
So it's run by civilians, and it's basically leisure time for naval people. And every base around the world has this division, as far as I know.
Active.
Yeah.
A naval.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. So if you're deployed in Japan, because that's where I was going to go, they had at the base in Japan, because it was on the ocean, they had a sailing center.
Like a Club Med for sailors.
Kind of, yeah. So you'd live on the Navy base, and then you'd teach sailing to the naval guys during their time off. And the way it worked, though, they ranked the applicants, and then they'd give you your choice based on where they ranked you. Well, I happened to be the first, I got first dibs on where I wanted to go. And I said, But at the same time, I'd also applied for an internship on the Chesapeake, working on a schooner that does tourist trips down there. And I said to the Navy people, I said, well, this sounds really cool, but like, can I have some time to think about it? And they said, yeah, you can let us know in 24 hours. It's like, great.
They have a way different time perspective than other people.
So I even called, the Woodwind up, and I said, hey, I have this other opportunity. They hadn't even interviewed me yet. They said, well, fair enough, you have a good resume, but we're not going to tell you on the phone. Like, we need to interview you and do our due diligence first. So I said no to the Japan guys and ended up working on the Woodwind. But that was where I realized, like, you can actually make a career in sailing, because my internship was paid and there was a direct path to, like, get a captain's license and do that sort of thing. And that's when it first occurred to me, well, maybe this could be cool. So that was the combination of, okay, here's something I'm passionate about. I didn't realize you could make a living out of it, but actually maybe you can. And then it kind of went from there.
But apart from sailing, have you had because I know you're a skier as well.
Mm.
So what role did nature play, like, for you growing up?
I was always outside. I mean, I grew up water skiing in the summertime, snow skiing in the wintertime. Sailing.
You had like ski resorts and mountains close by.
Crappy ones.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit bigger than Hammarbybacken.
Okay. So that's on that scale.
Yeah, bigger than that.
Mm.
But an hour from our house is where I learned how to snow ski in the wintertime. And we used to, and it was cool because my dad and my uncle and my cousins and stuff, who all skied together, they were real gung-ho about it. So like when we went skiing, we'd wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and be the first person on the lift that day and the last person off. And that was really cool. And they were competitive water skiers growing up and stuff, and everything was always like full on hardcore. And I was given a choice in middle school, as far back as I guess elementary school even. I either had to play a sport or be in the band. I had to do some extracurricular activity. My parents said, you got to do something. You can't just come home after school and be here. So I always chose sports. So I played baseball and I played tennis and I played golf and I played football, and it was always outside. I mean, that wasn't really a
punishment for you.
No, not at all. I mean, I played video games too. I had all the video game systems and all that stuff, but there was always ample opportunity to be outside. And I was spoiled. My dad had a ski boat and they had the means to take us snow skiing and stuff. So, there was definitely that part of it, but it was always outside.
But you were never afraid of like, now I'm going to focus on sailing, so I can't like partake in like these other activities. Now it's all 100% like sailing.
Yeah, that's still like...
That's still a problem for you?
Well, with skiing particularly, like if it wasn't for sailing, I would live in the mountains somewhere and I would have done something. I don't know how that would have developed, but it would have been something with that, because that's my other major. And it's not just the act of skiing, it's being in the mountains.
Yeah.
That's, you know, as much of it as the act of skiing. That said, actually snow skiing downhill, when I'm physically going down a mountain, that is by far the most fun I ever have had playing sports. Like that just puts you in the moment, and like I love that. But it's about living. It's a lifestyle thing too. I mean, we've set up this sailing thing as a lifestyle as opposed to a career, so that's important to me as well. I forget what the question was.
Oh, me too. Never mind. But it isn't like, I often think that there's a lot of similarities between, and maybe we will touch upon that later, but that there's a lot of similarities between sailing and alpinism. I don't know, with everything from like the rope handling and the fact that you are highly exposed, but you do it in a super controlled manner, and that you have to kind of tread lightly and tread slowly, and really you have to really master the way of, handling yourself in these elements.
And no, you're exactly right. And this is the reason why I think, you know, to have you on my podcast, you're not a sailor. You've done some sailing things
it's so embarrassing. I've been on a sailboat, but we never even raised sails.
But you understand what it's like. You lived on it for a few days, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
On Siggy's boat. On Siggy's boat, to that. But the point is, you hit the nail on the head. It's exact. You are learning to live with and in nature at its most rawest form, and how to not make it about you versus nature. It's making a more holistic approach of, okay, the weather is what it is. Here's the tools we have to deal with it. Whether you're in the ocean or on a mountaintop doesn't really make a difference. It's the same philosophy. And then some of the specifics, like rope handling and stuff, like you say, is actually transferable, those skills. But it's mainly the mental side of it. In fact, our sort of tagline for the passage business that we run is sharing the wisdom of the high seas with those wise enough to seek it out. And I stole that word for word, except for one, from a backcountry skiing operation in Canada. I forget what the company is, but the line was sharing the wisdom of the backcountry with those wise enough to seek it out. And I was like, it's exactly the same thing. But I'm curious to your background. I mean, you and I have sort of had parallel tracks with regards to, you've got this outdoor podcast that's been a passion of yours that's allowed you to do all these other cool opportunities, and the podcast I started has literally allowed me to build a business on top of it. But what was your growing up like, and how did you relate to that as a kid?
I come from the Swedish countryside, and it's really puts us like in the middle of Sweden, more or less, like southern the southern part, kind of.
What town is there? What's it called?
Well, the district is called Dalarna.
Okay.
And it's like dense forests, like pine forests, and.
So, like, we were just up in. Salin, the lake.
Yeah, it's
that's Dalarna, isn't it?
That's Dalarna, yeah. But it's like 3 hours south.
Okay.
Salin is like 3 hours drive north from where I grew up.
Okay.
But yeah, that's where I grew up, and we really, like, when you went sailing, we went out in the forest like all year round, like wintertime skiing. We had this old snowmobile, and we went out like every weekend, I think, and like out like. Picking berries in the autumn, picking mushrooms in the autumn, and went like swimming in the summertime, and skiing, and I don't know, bird watching, and joining my father as he went like hunting for elks and roe deers and so on. So that was, I mean, just going out like watching for animals and out hiking in the mountains. So that's where I come from, and that's the base of my passion for the outdoors, I think. Very not a lot of adrenaline, but a lot of experience, I think.
What did your parents do?
When I was a kid, actually, my father worked as a
ranger,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. When I was really small, my mom was at home. And then later she started working like at a library and stuff, but my dad really he worked in the forest from when he was like 16 or 17 or something. Mm-hmm. So that's really the base of the family, I think.
Is that outdoor foresty mushroom picking, berry picking? That's very Swedish, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah.
Because I I'm wondering if it's just because those are the Swedes I've. Like Mia's could tell almost exactly the same story. They just grew up playing in the forest. Mm. Is that a Swedish thing, or is that just because you guys grew up in the countryside?
Mainly, maybe because we grew up in the countryside. I don't see a lot of people go like berry picking in the Stockholm suburbs. I don't know, but at least not these days. But
at the same time, isn't the city like completely deserted on midsummer and during the
summer break?
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, and of course, I mean, just that we have this thing called allemansrätten, like the I don't know, you are probably better to explain it than I am. But the right you have the right to camp out like in nature, like wherever you want, as long as you don't, of course, cause any damage and you. Leave nothing but footprints behind and so on. But it's very a very important part of the Swedish psyche, I think. And I mean, we went like cross country skiing in school, for instance, like wintertime and so on. Now, of course, that's from an international perspective. Of course, that's fairly unique, I think.
Well, I think what else is unique, just from my own observations, having spent a fair amount of time here now. For example, you go to a elementary school. We picked up our niece and nephew the other day to take them to a movie, and it was snowing outside. It was probably -5, but everyone was outside, just dressed for it. Like the elements. How does that play into your relationship with being outside? Because you have such a long winter here, you know, most Americans would think, well, that's ridiculous to have the kids outside on a day like that.
I think there's only one way you got to accept it, I think. I mean, that's the thing. And I mean, and that's going back to where I grew up. We had this house, and the oldest part of the house is from the 17th century. And it's like a wooden house and like wood stoves.
Yeah.
And we had like every winter, every time we had like a storm, we knew that we were gonna have a blackout, and we would have like blackouts for like sometimes like a couple of days.
Yeah.
But we had these wood stoves, and we had like candles, and we had our own well, so we were fine. And of course that I think that affected me a lot more than I could imagine, I think. So, like, when I turned, like turning 30, I think, I really started to miss that life, like living in Stockholm. Stockholm is not the the biggest city in the world, but I mean, it's still kind of a fairly big city, and you live a certain life here. But I really started to long back to that, like the simple life outdoors and so on.
As a kid growing up, though, was that stuff like, were the inconveniences of that life annoying?
We didn't think of that at all, okay. Actually. No.
Yeah.
We just dealt with it. Yeah. But we definitely didn't, we did not suffer through it.
The reason I ask is because the thing, like I was, like I said, I was am a lazy person, but we live in a farmhouse now where the house is heated by hot water that runs through pipes that you have to heat from a wood stove out in the shed that's 50 yards from the house. And teenage me would have hated the chore of going out to do that. But now that's my routine in the morning. I get up and the first thing I do is go outside and make a fire. And I love that. And like, I wonder if you took that for granted, that sort of harder lifestyle in the countryside as a kid, and now that you live in an apartment and have it relatively easy, that's why you miss it.
I don't know. And I wish, a big part of me wish that I would say that that as a kid that I always like helped out, like chopping woods, and that was a natural part, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
We were too spoiled by mom and dad. And they did everything. And of course, the teenage me is probably glad for that, but the old me is the outdoor hipster part of me is sad that I didn't have to learn the basic like axe skills as a kid.
It's funny. I asked my birthday's next week, and Mia's like, "What do you want for your birthday?"
An axe.
Like, I did. I want an axe. So hopefully, she's getting me an axe for my birthday. So what did you? I mean, you've had a presumably a circuitous path to get to where you are now. So what did you do in high school and college, and what did you think you wanted to do?
I never really had a plan. I never had a serious plan. In one way I could have used someone like older, like mentoring me. But then again, if I had that, I wouldn't be sitting here maybe. I do remember I wanted to become a journalist as a like, I don't know, 13, 14 years old or something.
Do you remember why?
No. Probably it seemed cool. Run around with a camera. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I've always been kind of a storyteller, I think. Really into books, like reading. And I've always had like good grades in Swedish. And I always got like very good good like reviews and grades for short stories and stuff.
Okay, like made up stuff, like fiction.
Yeah, like fiction.
Really?
Yeah, as a kid, yeah.
Huh.
So I guess I was kind of a dreamer in many ways, and for some reason I was into I don't know, Far East Asia. Like China, Japan, and I remember training like jujutsu for like 6 years or something.
Okay,
and I was into that thing, and so at some point I thought it would be a good idea to study Japanese. So I applied for Japanese, and my secondhand alternative was Chinese, and I started Chinese because I didn't get end up in the Japanese class, and this is Stockholm University.
Okay.
So I started with that, and then again, I didn't have like a, I really don't know what, I can't remember that I had a crystal clear plan of what I wanted to do with that. But I studied that for 1 year in Stockholm and then 1 year in Shanghai because we had the opportunity to go abroad and study like 2 semesters in Shanghai. And at that point, I think if you had asked me then, I would say that I wanted to work in like the State Department or the equivalent of that in Sweden.
Really?
Yeah, with focus on like East Asian affairs or like something like that. I'm not good with languages. I'm very good in I'm like a parrot, you know. I can imitate like very well,
yeah.
And like learn stupid phrases and so on. And the pronunciation is my strong side, and the grammar is like really my poor side.
That's so funny you say that, because I have the same thing, especially with Swedish.
Yeah.
I've never taken like a formal Swedish class, but I'm around Mia's family and people that speak really good Swedish, so I'm good at imitating it, like you say. I think when I talk to people in Swedish, I think they think I'm better in Swedish than I am, because I pronounce things well.
Because you know all the correct curse words.
Yeah, exactly. So that's funny.
And then coming home after Shanghai, I took like I studied something called the East Asian program. So it was like history, politics, and economy about China, Korea, and Japan. And that was super interesting. Really, really, really interesting. And at that point, that was the autumn of 2001. And that was September 2001. And the 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sparked my interest in international relations and politics. So I decided to study political science. And I did that for like 3 years or something.
Did you get a degree?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I have like, I don't know, 2 or 3 degrees or something.
Wow.
I never used one of them. But I was like for quite a long time, I was kind of bitter of the that I had these like 6 years of university degrees, 6 years of university studies. And I really couldn't shape something out of that. It was just a bunch of like, I don't know, knowledge like that I wasn't able to focus it on something, and I ended up working in like finance sector, but not at a high level, but kind of administrative
so
level.
You had a real job for a while.
I had a real job, yeah.
And how long did that last?
4 years or something.
Really?
I think, yeah.
At what point did you decide, like, I got to get out of this?
At the point where I like smashed a keyboard at my office, and I'm a very calm guy. I'm not violent at all, and I didn't smash it, but I like slammed my fist into it, so the pegs and everything like flew, and I knew that, well, this is enough for me. But then I had started this podcast, this Husky podcast. I had that going, and I kind of knew that, well, I could try this out, or an offshoot of that.
The podcast was sort of a hobby that you just did outside of work,
on
your own time.
Yeah, because I started, I know this was 2012, 2013, and like 1 or 2 years before that, I had started listening a lot to like Swedish radio on the go. Like I think it was, I don't know if it was a smartphone or MP3 player, but I listened to a lot of like documentaries, like radio documentaries, like out walking for like 2 hours listening, and I really like got like really sucked into this. It was so intimate, and I really loved the, to kind of zoom out, but still I would walk around in like the forest or in the city, but I was like in my own kind of bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed and still enjoy that a lot. And I had never heard of podcasts at that point. And this was maybe, I don't know, 2011, maybe 2010, 2011. And then the podcast thing started happening in Sweden. And after a while, I was out running with 2 friends. And more or less out of the blue, I got this idea that, hey, we should do a podcast. Like, and I didn't have a plan at that point. Like, I think I wanted it to be about like not adventure racing, but kind of outdoor sports, where we would kind of discuss, okay, so what's going on now, like this month,
newsy type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's, I think it was a good thing that it didn't take off. And my friend was like, oh, no, we don't know what you're talking about. Keep running. And like 6 months later, I had this like epiphany or something. I had really, well, this is how it should be. I know that if I do it like this, if I do it like the way I want it to be, I know that it would work. I know it would be well received, and I know that people would listen to it. And then I just made it happen.
How did you make the decision to quit your job, or did you? How did that go down?
It kind of, I don't know. I had no other option at that point. I don't dare to think what would have happened if I stayed there, because I was unwell at that point. Like I wasn't a happy man.
Because this is the hardest thing I try to pin down, because a lot of people that listen to my podcast are people that want to either take a 1 or 2 year sabbatical and then come back to work, or quit for good. And that's always the hardest decision. How do you get over that hump? Or it's people, younger people that are in the same situation you were, where they have a real job and hate themselves and their job. And so how do you get over that hump? I mean,
I was at that point, I was like, I didn't have any family or anything. I was just single by myself, and I didn't have any responsibilities to anyone. And actually it was down to that point that I remember thinking, like, from a philosophical point of view, I could not motivate spending this much time and energy on something that I detest.
Yeah.
No, if from a philosophical, you know, it would be it wouldn't be it's like a insult to life from like a universal perspective.
Yeah.
I was at that point. So it was actually, it was so easy to get that, you know, to do that decision. And I think I had done, because I started it like February, March or something, 2013. And I think I quit my job like that autumn. So I had done like 1 or 2 episodes. I wasn't paid for those, but I think I did like kind of cooperations. So I knew that, you know, that it would be a possibility to actually make money from this.
Mm-hmm. So you, excuse me, you went into it from the get-go as this is going to be a potential career avenue for me, not just...
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've never done anything to like kind of maximize profit. Like,
yeah.
I will do this to get money, because, you know, I've had people asking me, or still get people asking me, like, oh, I want to do a podcast, like, and, you know, to give advice and so on. And people want to make money, like, and they want to make money straight away, and it's like, well, that's not going to happen. Mm. Like, if you want to make money, you shouldn't start a podcast, I think.
Exactly.
I mean, but if you should start a podcast if you have something to say, if you have a story to tell, if you have, like, if you have a vision of something. And I think I made a podcast that I myself wanted to listen to.
Yeah, that's the key, I think.
Yeah, and I guess it was the same for you.
Yeah, it started for me as a hobby. I mean, I actually started a different podcast called Two Inspired Guys. It was me and my best friend from college, and we wanted to talk to people that had made a life out of whatever they were passionate about.
Okay.
In any field.
I didn't know that.
It was going to be an interview show. The two of us would co-host it and just talk to people. He had some, like, his kind of thing was like restaurant business and food and that sort of stuff, and mine was sailing. So talk to people in these various fields, with the thread being they do a non-traditional career and have made a lifestyle out of it. And we did 30 episodes.
Wow.
It's embarrassing to listen to now. I mean, but
is it still out there?
Yeah, it's still live. You can still find it. And I have visions of like bringing it back one day, because I still think it's still a concept that I'm interested in. Because I also, aside from the sailing, I have very deep-rooted entrepreneurial instincts that come from my grandfather, there's been a family business ever since my dad still runs a restaurant that my grandfather started in 1952.
Wow.
So that part, you know, I grew up in a household that was very non-traditional. My dad never had a real job. I never had a real job. So I say too, if I wasn't in sailing, I would be doing something for myself, bottom line. So that kind of got me started on And then it ended up being a lot of sailing people because that was my world. And my friend Ryan, we weren't in the same town. We did everything on Skype, and it was just really hard to do it. I was like, I'm just going to start my own sailing one. And then it just kind of went from there. But it was a chance. It was an excuse for me to talk to people that I wanted to talk to that otherwise might not have talked to me just over a cup of coffee.
Yeah, but was it like famous people?
Yeah, some, and some who weren't. I mean, I've done 176 episodes now. A lot of them are famous people in the sailing world. But what you quickly realize, you probably have had the same experience in the outdoor world, is they seem famous in their world, but they're just normal people.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't have, they're not real celebrities, so you have access and you have a personal touch to it that you can come across in an interview like this that I think is different with real celebrities. Mm-hmm. Pop culture celebrities, that kind of thing.
But do you get a lot of emails and like when people meet you that they are into this?
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row, dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Non-traditional way of living, like, because that's a really big thing for me as well. And that's something that I'm really inspired of, and I love talking to someone if I have a friend or someone who are in the same state of mind that I was a couple of years ago, and that they want to do something, and I love like inspiring people like that.
Yeah, I get that. That's probably the most common email, because the medium of podcasting in general is consumed by younger people just by default because it's a tech thing. So I get a lot of 20-something kids that ask that question. How do you get started? How do you take that one? And to be fair, the answer you gave, it still doesn't answer the core of the question, is because it's the fear that's involved, people of stepping out of their comfort zone, and why some people do it and why others don't. Because a lot of people share those feelings and those thoughts. But it's hard to pin down why some people go for it and some don't.
Yeah.
And I'm not expecting you to answer it. I don't think anybody can answer it. It is just a feeling. But to be able to encourage and inspire other people to like that it is okay to take those kind of risks, I think. And I think maybe what has to do with it too, I mean, you and I both having this sort of outdoor wilderness type of thing, like it doesn't seem as risky when you're okay not having anything. If you can be content living in a tent in the middle of the woods for a week, well, if I take a risk and the business I start fails, if I start back from square one again, that's not the end of the world. You know, you want to avoid getting comfortable, I guess, in one sense.
Yeah, maybe. But also, when I talk to people about starting my own business and people starting their own business, it's kind of two different kind of discussion, so two different kind of people. It's either the people who they would love to start their own business, but they don't know what that would be. And then you have the people who would love to start their own business and they know exactly what they would do, but they don't dare to take the steps. And that's, I guess, what you're aiming at.
And I think the people that want to do it that don't know where to start, I mean, it's super cliche, but I think it's true, ask yourself, what would you do if you didn't need to make money?
Yeah, it's...
And that's...
You know this Alan Watts?
Mm-hmm.
You know of him, a British like philosopher, and I have this. There's this like excerpt from one of his lectures. It's like a three minute like you can find it on YouTube. If money was no object, and I've sent that to numerous people, like numerous friends, like having these discussions, and I'm like sending them that YouTube clip because it's. It makes sense. It's super cliche in one way, but it makes sense. Like, find something that you love, and you will be a master of it. And break this. I don't know this spell of like working with something that you don't like to get money that you don't need to buy stuff that you don't need. So it's
This has been
a vicious circle.
I'm really lucky to have the parents I had because my dad was extremely practical and was the entrepreneurial mindset. My mom was very spiritual in a universal sense, not religious at all, but spiritual and philosophical. So her mantra to me was always, do what you love and the money will follow.
Yeah.
Ever since high school, that was just, she just beat it into my brain. And then my dad perfectly sort of accompanied that with his mantra was, there's always room at the top. Meaning if you're the best at whatever it is you're doing, if you're one of the best, you will always have work because you will always be in demand.
Yeah, that's true. I never heard it put like that before, but it's, yeah.
So regardless of what your field is, if you're good at it, you will have something to do on some level. And I love that. It's basically find a passion and work really hard at it. There's no shortcut. It's not difficult.
I'm very fond of this Henry Ford quote that Steve Jobs also followed up on, that they did not believe in like marketing research.
Right.
Like when they wanted to introduce a new product, they didn't give a shit about the market.
The public doesn't know what they want.
Exactly. Yeah. Hence the Henry Ford quote, like if I wanted to give the people what they wanted, I would give them a faster horse.
Yeah.
And I think that's super good, and I'm not too like set me on the side of I compare myself to Henry Ford and so on, but I knew that if I would make this product that people wanted, this podcast, this product that I wanted to listen to, I wanted like people like me would probably want to listen to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So dare to as a recommendation to dare to like believe that your own ideas are good. And also, it doesn't have to be so permanent. Like, okay, so you quit your job. I mean, so give it a try for like 6 months or like work 50%, like work part-time. If you want to move someplace, well, do it. It doesn't mean that you can never, ever return to where you come from. And I think in Sweden, I'm guessing that we are very more rooted in a way, like so you're moving to Stockholm now. Well, bye bye. See you never ever again. But I mean, and if someone moves to Stockholm and then 2 years later or something decide to move back, it's like, oh, so they moved back. They didn't make it. And it's very and I was probably like that before as well. But it's very. I don't know. It's just try it out.
Mm.
It doesn't have to be, for good.
No, and also along the same lines, I mean, you mentioned all your years of education. Well, none of that stuff's ever wasted. I mean, I can't tell you how many creative things I've started and just that got swept under the rug because they didn't go anywhere. But like all that stuff has... You take bits and pieces from all these different
Definitely,
experiences
yeah.
to create things that actually do stick.
Yeah, and it's like no matter what, it shaped me into the person I am now, and persons I've gotten to know along the way, and everything. So now these days I'm not bitter at all. Like 3 or 4 years ago, you know, paying my student loan back and so on, I was bitter because it felt like I had this like academic heavy backpack, rucksack, like weighing me down. But I've left that behind me, and now I'm just a happy camper.
On your point of the, you know, giving people what they want versus making what you want to make, I still struggle with that. You know, we have the business where we take people ocean sailing, and I get nervous when I set up the calendar of where we're going to go, because we can decide completely where we're going to go, when we're going to go there. And I worry, like, oh, maybe people want to, maybe they'll be easier to sell if we go back to the Caribbean or this and that. And I've talked to mentors who have similar businesses, and they've basically just assured me, go where you want to go and people will come.
Yeah.
And, but it's hard to do that, especially when they're, like, this is high stakes. I mean, my whole business is riding on this. I have to sell these trips. That's how I make a living. But I still struggle with that. Like, oh, man, just today, me and I were talking. I wonder how many people are going to actually book our Arctic trips, and is that going to be harder and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, so far, I have no reason to think they won't. It's just, you still have those doubts.
But that's the, to analyze your business, that's the core. You have the sailboat, you have Isbjørn, and with the boat you set out a route for like 1 year ahead of something, and people can reach out to you and say that, hey, I want to be on that stage, and they like
sign up. Yeah, so the
and they pay you for that, and then they it's not like a working crew.
They, yes, it is, but they also pay to be there.
Yeah.
So basically, they can be as active or not in the crew as they want to be. 99% of the time, they want to come along either to scratch an itch or to get experience so they can go do it on their own boat someday. So they get experience with us in a as much of a controlled environment as you can have in the middle of the ocean.
But you get people that never have set foot on a sailboat before.
Not often, but yes, we have. We had a guy, our very first ever trip from Annapolis up to Lunenburg was 700 miles. A bus driver from Canada who'd read an article back in like the 80s or something about being able to see the stars down to the horizon.
Wow.
And he's like, I want to see that one day. And he always wanted to learn how to sail, but he always wanted to do an ocean passage. So he said, well, I'm not going to waste all my money taking sailing lessons at the club if I don't like the ocean passage. I want to see.
Smart man.
I want to see if I like that. If I like that, and I think I will, then I'll go back and learn how to sail. So that's what he did. He and I were watch partners. He steered. I couldn't get him off the wheel. He steered the whole time. Every time we were on watch, he steered the full 3 hours, and he absolutely loved it. And he went on. He did a trip to South Africa to take sailing lessons down there, and has continued it. So
it was a life changer for him.
Yeah, it's really cool to see that. You know, I've done a lot of miles now offshore, and it's easy to take things for granted that you do a lot. And I'm conscious about not taking it for granted, but it's a lot easier not to take it for granted when you're seeing it through fresh eyes every time. When you get to see the joy that people that haven't seen that setting before, and you remember, oh yeah, I know what he's looking at. I know how he feels. I love that.
Do you hear that a lot, that you offer something to people that changed their lives?
All the time. It's super cool. One specific trip, not with our business, actually. Mia and I worked for a company called Broadreach for a summer. And it was basically, we joke now that what we do is adult Broadreach, because back then it was high school kids that would go on these. They did expedition type stuff in various settings around the world, but we were involved in their sailing programs in the Caribbean. And I'm still in touch with some of these kids who were 16, 17, 18 at the time. This was in 2008. So now they're like out of college, having kids and stuff. And they still are in touch with us a little bit here and there about how much that experience, wow, it was a 32-day trip living on the boat, impacted their lives. And that's super cool. And I still think of all, I'm most passionate about influencing young people into following their passions. Like if I can give anything back, that's what I want. And to that end, we have an intern working for us now, Liz, who is super cool, and like she's in the middle of changing her life and stuff like that. And I like that more than anything. But I wanted to ask you, you've had some really interesting experiences because of the podcast, got invited on these different trips and stuff. I mean, what, this is sort of a two-part question. Like, were you, when you were working your normal job, were you doing active sports and stuff like that? Or how did you evolve to that, and how do you, what have been some of the cool stories you've had because of the podcast?
I guess the podcast came to me in a, well, that sounded very religious. The podcast came to me at a moment in, at a period of my time, I would say, when I kind of, as we talked about earlier, that I kind of reconnected with my roots, like going like snowboarding again, how I really, really appreciated that. And together with friends, we went up like hiking in the mountains in the autumn time, and went like trail running and so on. So that was my activities, I would say, like hiking, trail running, and winter, like ski touring, mm-hmm. like with a split board. So that was one door into this husky universe that I created, because I went up to three winters in a row or something. We went up at a ski touring camp organized by Haglöfs up north in Sweden, and there I made some of the first like connections within the outdoor industry. And when I had put out my first ever episode, I like same evening or like the day after, I sent an email to the then marketing manager of Haglöfs, and I'm like, hey, you gotta listen to this now. And he's like, I've already done it. It's really good. Wow. I really like what you're doing.
Who was the first episode?
That was Mikael Lindnord, the adventure racer who had ended up adopting a dog from Ecuador. Okay. And that led to the connection with Haglöfs led to an interview with Marcus Hellner, which is like Olympic.
Yeah, the cross country skier. Yeah.
So that I was on the wind. So it gave me a really good start, and so I was, to answer your question, I was already I had started going on like ski trips and so on, and this gave extra fuel, of course.
I think also it gives you extra almost credibility in a way, because you're talking to the people. Yes, some of them, like Marcus Hellner, are on a totally different level. No. But you relate to them in a way because you've done these activities. You're living the lifestyle, mm-hmm. as opposed to being a pure journalist where you're just, yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know, definitely. But that's one of my fears, that I don't want to be like a bystander. I don't want to be a commentator. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to participate in as many activities as possible. And I am not at all a very I don't see myself as a very like physical person. I have endurance and I have a certain amount of willpower, but I don't see myself as a avid I'm a pretty good, like, I guess I'm a pretty good snowboarder when it comes to the ski touring part, but and like I said, I have good endurance, but still, I really love. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I really cherish the possibilities I have now to kind of learn, to kind of step. This is my. Here goes. This is kind of my chance to. I will never be, and I could have never have been this sponsored athlete, right. of any kind. But this is kind of my way to still kind of open the door into their world, step in, and you know, give it a try. Mm-hmm. Because the fantastic thing is once you get to you end up like doing activities with these guys and girls, and you find out they're not like divas and they're not like smart asses of any kind. It's like super humble people, and you never feel like you're in the way or something, and they just welcome you with open arms, and that's fantastic. And to getting to learn, like, I don't know, going like swim run adventure camps with really good, like, fit and able people, and be able to participate to some degree, it's of course it's mind-blowing. Mm.
I met a guy in New Zealand, the same trip I met Mia on, actually. He was a professional triathlete that had an Ironman in Wanaka, and he ended up winning. He was staying in our hostel, but it was the same thing. Like, wow, this guy's, he was a professional athlete. It's what he did for a living, and he was super humble just hanging out with us in the hostel. Yeah. In the hostel. We ended up volunteering for the race and working there, and he won, but it was just really cool. Like you said, open, and people just, they're just normal people.
Because I think it's these are the kind of people that they made that decision to, yeah. I will shape my life around what I love. And usually people like that tend to be like very decent folks, yeah. nice people yeah. and inspiring people.
I can relate to your fear of not wanting to be a bystander, because we, for the last, well, since 2008, have worked on and off for a sailing event management company. And it always killed me. It was on the surface, it sounded like a dream job. Like, you get to travel a ton, work in sailing, make your own schedule, blah, 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 get a good salary every month. But I was always the one doing all the briefings and here's what the weather's going to be. And then I'd stand there and untie their dock lines and watch everyone else sail away. And it's like, this is backwards. I want to be them. Mm-hmm. And that never sat well with me. And I enjoyed it. It was fun, but it was never the end. It was always, okay, what can I do now with this experience to then let me be the guy on the other end of that? And now that's where we're at, which is really cool. So I know the feeling of being, the fear of being left behind, I guess. But you've been to Iceland and Svalbard and done some of these amazing trips. Yeah. We're headed there next year on our boat. So. What can you tell me about either of those places?
Yeah, was it 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago? I had this chance to go to Svalbard on like a 10-day like ski touring trip. Mm. Like, we were based on a boat, not a sailboat, but like an old, built like 1955 or something, like an old school, super charming boat. And coming home after that, I remember like for 2-3 days, no joke, I was depressed because I didn't want it to be over, like, because it was such an adventure. Mm. Like, great crew, like awesome crew, awesome people. And of course, wake up every day, have breakfast, jump into the Zodiacs, jump ashore, and then go ski touring on like peaks and glaciers that probably, like, no one have ever skied those areas, and we did it. And it was amazing. And of course, to be able to, we saw one polar bear.
Cool.
The season afterwards, they saw like 10. But it's kind of course, you want to see them, but you want to choose the time when you see them.
Yeah.
But it's Svalbard is it's really amazing. It's like, it's proper wilderness. And you have to remember, of course, that you are very, very remote, and like, help is like a couple of hours with helicopter away. So you should know what you're doing.
How did they handle that? Like, the outfit that you were with, like.
I mean, we went with two, like, licensed mountain guides, mm-hmm. That I have like 100% confidence in, and they had been there before. And they also had a setup with, there were always like one guy in the staying in the Zodiac with a rifle to kind of scout the shoreline for polar bears. And then being up on the like ski touring and then skiing, eventually skiing down, of course, we never took any chances. They always stayed on the paths and slopes and areas in the mountains where they knew that, well, this is safe. Mm.
It brings up the point we sort of touched on before of responsibility in these wilderness areas. You're the second non-sailing person I've had on the podcast. Another one was a guy called Drew Hardesty, who was a avalanche rescue guy out in Utah when I was on a ski trip out there. And it's the same concept, because you have, especially in the Arctic, you get a lot more people going there, and it is pretty much, yeah, you need to get the permits and this and that, but there's nothing stopping you from going there. Same thing with crossing an ocean. Nobody's telling you, no, you can't do that. And then you get these accidents that happen, these whole high profile things, because people end up in positions they have no business being in because they don't have the education and the training and the knowledge and the respect mainly.
But they still rely on people coming there to rescue them.
Yeah, they have this idea of hitting the big red button, so to speak. And I mean, how have you seen that in the people you've talked to in the wilderness, sort of land-based wilderness stuff? How is that addressed?
I would say, like, everyone I get in contact with, they are highly professional and they are extremely aware of what they are doing. And when I talk about like mountain awareness and so on, if anything, I think the broad like what people would say is that at the end of the day, it's you have to respect everyone's decision. Like, okay, so I can tell you that you should not go down this slope because it's avalanche prone terrain and so on. I think you really shouldn't. But if that person is like, well, yes, I know that, but I still want to ski this. Like, it's in the end, it's down to that each person's decision in a way, and that person's freedom. I guess.
No, I see that, but how does it impact? Like, if that person does that and causes an accident, the ultimate, side effect of that is that there may be regulation to stop people from accessing those places in the first place. That's, I guess, not the fear, but that's the consequence that comes out of that. Same thing. You can cross an ocean with your family, no problem. Now, because there's no law saying you can't, but maybe there will be if more of this stuff keeps out. It's the kind of the, you know, one bad egg spoils it for everyone. Does that must come up in mountaineering, especially the idea of who's responsible. I guess it's a different thing in the U.S. too, because we have such a litigious society that they're more prone to, oh, if he causes an avalanche, I can sue him.
Yeah,
that kind of stuff. Probably you because don't have that as much here.
No, and we don't have these like lines that you shouldn't cross or something, and the gates to the off-piste areas. You don't have that system in Scandinavia. It's much more open for for good and bad, I guess. Mm. So I don't know. Actually, I don't. No, I don't know what to add to that, actually. It's
I mean, it's refreshing, I guess, to not have that here. That, I mean, that Allemansrett thing you talked about earlier, that's a perfect example of that would never exist in the U.S. That's just a foreign concept. Mm. Well, that's private property. You get shot if you go over there. So,
but does that happen, like, is that common that people decide to cross the Atlantic Ocean and then they end up in trouble?
It's not common, but I guess it's my world. Anytime something happens, I know about it. So it's more of like once you're embedded so deeply in whatever it is, you hear more about it. Yeah. So you think maybe it's more common than it is. But inevitably there's always a reason as to why something happened. And it's always down to the choices the person made long before they ever left. Not always, but a lot of times. It's rarely down to bad luck, is my opinion on the matter, and that's very debatable. But choices people make with regards to the type of boat they tend to do it on, and all this other stuff, because it's different than going skiing, for example, because you're relying on your physical fitness and your knowledge of the terrain. But when you're crossing an ocean, you're relying on the boat itself. You've got to take care of the boat, which will then take care of you. But there's different choices in that, and there's different. It's always a compromise. It's you want a boat that's going to be comfortable to live on when you're not sailing. But the things that make it comfortable to live on at the dock are exactly what you don't want when you're out in the ocean with big waves and the potential for heavy weather. So a lot of times, people tend to choose towards the comfort side, and that later then gets them in trouble. Mm. And that's what I beat to death in these podcasts is, you know, make your decisions based on what the boat was designed to do, and don't be surprised. People are always surprised when stuff happens to, I mean, you wouldn't go off-roading in a car that's not four-wheel drive. It's the same sort of idea, but it's, I don't know. it's a different subject.
Yeah.
I'm gonna bore you with this technicality of it anyway with sailing.
No, but it's very interesting, and this when tragedy happens and someone gets killed, like on the mountains or something, you always hear this like, well, at least he or she died doing what they love, and I guess I can see that from two perspectives. And of course, it's yes, they did, but still, it's such a tragedy. Sometimes it feels like I don't know if it's all that good that in a way, it's kind of, I don't know if it's like glorifying the living on the edge, like if they glorify that a bit too much. I don't know.
I don't think it's, from my point of view, I think it's bullshit because I'm terrified of dying offshore. Like, I talked to my therapist about this, like legitimately, it is not worth it to me. I don't like it that much to give up everything I have. Like, but at the same time, I can't do anything else. It's not a win. There's no such thing as dying doing what you love. But at the same time, I wouldn't be happy living a life without doing that. But that doesn't mean I'm willing to die for it. But it's not, you can't resolve that conundrum. Do you know what I mean? It's a paradox that's not resolvable. I would never say, yes, it's worth dying for. It's not. But at the same time, I'm not going to stop doing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Because, there's always a scale, isn't it? I mean, you can spend your life sailing and you can, like, for 95% of the choices you make, you can always make safe choices,
yeah.
But you don't have to. I know too little of sailing, but you don't have. I'm gonna solo cross the whatever stream and bay and.
No, I know what you're saying, but
you don't always have to choose the most extreme.
Correct. In fact, I choose it. The opposite, the absolute most conservative way to get from A to B, because you got it. It's mainly choosing your seasons on the weather and this kind of stuff. But I think what I fear is, and I've thought about this a lot. When I'm the most scared on any of these offshore passages, is when I get too far inside my head, and it's not that something's actually happening on the boat. It's that I'm thinking about what possibly could happen. So it's a fear of, like anything else, a fear of not knowing. So like the worst thing is when you're offshore and the weather's getting worse and you don't know how bad it's going to get before it starts to get better again. That's really hard. But when I reflect on every time there has been a major incident or something, you don't go, and I'm glad that I react this way, but I don't get scared. You do what needs to be done. And I actually change into like this very laser focused adrenaline mode. So I think it's weird to say this, but I think if it came to the point where we were getting overwhelmed by the weather at sea or something, ironically, I don't think I would be scared. If I actually would die offshore, I don't think I would be scared in the instant before I died. But I guess I'm afraid of being afraid in that instant.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And for you, you are a sailor, and when you set your foot on your boat and you put on your, I don't know, your sailing clothes.
Your little captain's hat.
No, but you enter a mode and you enter a role, and in that role you will not get easily scared. And so
I wouldn't say too, and I don't identify as a sailor. I would identify more as when I'm in that mode, I'm in the professional mode, the mode of the leader. Mm-hmm. And that applies, I think, to whatever outdoor pursuit you're doing. I think that leadership aspect is what's crucial in all this stuff we've been talking about. And I don't identify as a sailor. I never did. I don't know why. But I do identify as a person in charge, and I take that very seriously. And I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's the mode I switch into.
When you get the chance to sail to Iceland, and when you will, because you really should, and I know you will meet up with Captain Siggy.
Mm.
You should discuss this, because I really don't want to state his thoughts on the matter. But because first of all, I don't remember it like entirely word for word. But he was very. We had a long discussion about this, casualties when it comes, like casualties in the mountains versus casualties on the ocean, and he was very. He had very strong opinions upon on this topic, and he made some very interesting parallels to like the fishing industries on Iceland, that he like 20, 30 years ago, it was kind of like, yeah, the people lost at sea. They were kind of, well, they were like, yeah, they died at sea. You know, it was
glorifying
in a way. And he could see similar trends in the, like, for instance, in the backcountry industry as well, or the backcountry scene. And he was very annoyed of that. And he said, that you can work your way around that. No one needs to die. It's a matter of like changing perspective and education, because that's what they did when it came to the fishing industry and the life at sea. And that was very interesting.
On the same level, I forget what I was going to say now. It was about, oh no, I know what it was about. It's the sort of the attitude that that fighter pilots often, you often hear fighter pilots talk about, where if there is an accident, something happens, the other people in that peer group tend to think, well, what did the person do wrong? Because it couldn't have been bad luck, because if it's bad luck, that means it could happen to me.
Yeah.
But if it was a human error, that means, well, I was better than him, so to speak. And I'm guilty of that as well. You look at different things, what would I have done differently? But sometimes it is just bad luck. And that's, I think, where my fear comes in. You do this stuff long enough and, I mean, stuff happens.
Yeah.
And that you can't control. You control everything you possibly can, but ultimately going into the wilderness in any of these, you're at the mercy of nature. But that's also the attraction to it in the first place. So,
but I just have to add that as a combination of at the level of my, I don't know, mountain skills, and a combination of that and the fact that I'm fortunate enough to have gone on fantastic tours with very professional people, I rarely, if ever, encounter what I would say like dangerous or extreme situations. I'm living a big part of my life on the safe side of things.
I mean, on that note, what have you not done yet that you still have in front of you? Like, how are you going to evolve this? Because it seems like you've figured out a pretty nice niche for yourself in your business and your podcast and in the other marketing things you're involved in, and it sounds like you've got it pretty well figured out, or is that just what it looks like?
That's the plan too. It's all about the facade. No, it's, you know, people ask me, like, for instance, like, who's your dream guest and so on. But in a way, I think the ultimate setup now would be to make fewer episodes, but to put like way much more work into every episode, like, because I do mainly, like you do, like interviews, like 60 to 90 minute long interviews with profiles in the outdoor industry. And I also do some, like, for instance, going to Svalbard and going to Iceland, going to whatever. I have done some episodes where I'm kind of a narrator and I make kind of an episode about this trip. And I really, really love that. But it takes, of course, much more time when it comes to post-production, planning and everything. But if I could choose, I would do maybe one episode every month, and that would be like a portrait of a person. For instance, if I would do a portrait on you, like it would be an interview with you where we sit down and record the interview, but I would also spend time with you, like, for instance, on Isbjørn, like out sailing. So it would be a smooth mix between the life on the boat with the guy behind the guy behind the boat.
More documentary style.
Definitely,
stuff,
yeah. But that's when it comes to like to get the economy to work and working with partners and sponsors. It's I think at least it would be a bit more difficult, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if you. It's I've had a hard time just getting people to understand that, like, what even a podcast is.
Yeah,
now finally
still,
we're over the hump with that and getting sponsors to do it, but we're still a little bit, I think, ahead of the curve in terms of media. Like, people are still stuck in the magazine format, at least in
something
sailing.
Something that they can hold, like grasp or something.
From the sponsor side of it, I mean,
exactly.
It's impossible to well, I should say, Weems and Plath has been awesome. They've signed on for a full year, and they're finally now establishing, okay, this is a thing now. Let's see where it can go. Mm-hmm. So, no, that sounds very cool.
Yeah.
Do you have concrete plans to do that, or is this just
no?
An idea?
It's just, you know, I have so many like weird ideas like floating around in my head, but and I'm trying to kind of mix it all together and get something productive out of it. But yeah. But what I also really really enjoy and what I'm curious of is all the opportunities that may arise like up ahead. It would be super interesting to get involved with some kind of, I don't know, video project or book project or something. So it's, you know, you never know.
But it's all in the creative vein, sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Cool. Well, this has been fun.
Yeah, it has. And hopefully someone will be able to make something out of this.
Cool. Well, thanks for the time, Magnus.
Thank you.
Husky is reported with support from Naturkompaniet and Holiday Club Åre. It is produced by Husky Productions. The music is made by Joel Mull.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.